Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. George Mason University folklorist and ethnographer Lisa Gilman stayed with refugee advocate, now BYU-Idaho student, Divine Irokoze's family in a Malawian refugee camp in November of 2021 while working on a project called My Culture, My Survival, Arts Initiatives by Refugees for Refugees. Since that first meeting, their lives have become intertwined professionally and personally. And they're jointly giving this year's Fife Folklore Honor Lecture at Utah State University called Refugees, Arts, and Advocacy. And they're joining us on the program today to talk about that. By the way, the talk is today, 1:30 p.m. in Merrill Kazir Library Room 101. Merrill Kazir Library Room 101. And the talk is presented by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, Harawi Peace Institute Folklore Program, University Libraries and Special Collections and Archives, all at Utah State University. So, Lisa Gilman, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're at George Mason University.
Yes.
It's in Virginia, right?
In Fairfax, Virginia.
Yeah.
Right outside of Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Do you teach, or is it all field work, or what?
So I teach and I do research and I write books and articles. And I'm also actually, this year, I'm a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., the think tank, nonpartisan think tank.
Okay, yeah. So Divine Irokoze,
mm-hmm.
and I'm saying that name kind of correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
Good job.
Wonderful. So you are right now a student.
Mm-hmm.
BYU-Idaho, I guess?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah, wonderful. So we'll get into some of your history and how the two of you met as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you studying?
I am studying international studies.
Okay.
And global affairs. So
yeah.
Yeah.
You were telling me before we went on the air, you're studying French. So one of your...
I am studying French,
yeah.
But it's a little bit hard to learn while old, but
yeah.
Hopefully I get it.
Yeah.
It's been hard, but
yeah.
Trying.
Well, if you're old, I'm incredibly old, so that's, but I'm okay. I'm okay being incredibly old. So you already speak four languages.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, you decided to add another one?
I speak English, Chichewa, and Swahili and Kirundi. So
yeah.
Kirundi, that's my local language, my mm-hmm. parents' language, because they originate from Burundi. And I learned all those in Malawi, in Teleka refugee camp where I grew up in. So, yeah.
Yeah. You learned those when you were young,
mm-hmm.
which is the time to learn languages, right?
Yes. And it was easy because I didn't have to go to school. So I didn't know that it's hard to learn a language in class. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
And that's probably why French is being a little bit hard, because
right.
I have to go to class for it.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah. Now, you were also telling me your father tried to teach you French when you were young.
He did.
The wisdom or foolishness of the young, you said, I don't really need this. Yeah.
Yeah. He tried to teach me because he speaks French. And I was like, I don't think I need French, because back then I was just in a refugee camp. I didn't see bigger picture if I would need it outside of the camp. I thought the only languages that I needed were the languages that were being spoken in the camp. But turns out I needed it. So he probably saw more than I did. So
yeah.
Here I am trying to learn it now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, folks listening might be wanting me to ask this question. I'm curious anyway. So your name, that's a very unique name.
Mm-hmm.
Divine.
It is Divine. Actually, I was told I was named Divine by my uncle that I didn't get a chance to see, but which I do appreciate because it's such a beautiful name. And Irokoze, it's in Kirundi, and that means Thanksgiving. So,
all right. Divine Thanksgiving.
Yes. Yeah, I get to have all the beautiful names.
That's a beautiful name, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Lisa Gilman, tell me a little bit about your work, how you... For one thing, ethnographic mm-hmm. research. A lot of people won't be familiar with that word. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I'm a folklorist, and my projects that I have done over the years have always been about some kind of artistic form, but not arts like the kind of high arts that end up in museums and galleries and concert halls, but more like art in everyday life, the role that arts play in life. And I've used arts as a way to study social and political issues. And I'm really interested in how people on the ground, everyday people, experience and respond to their political environment, their economic environment, their social environment. So in the projects that I have done over the years, I approach the way I do my research is using ethnographic methods, which means that I go and ideally live with people. And it's through living with people and watching and experiencing and doing myself what they're doing that I learn what they're experiencing, how they're thinking about things, how they feel about things. And so as an ethnographer, you do, as I said, ideally you live with people. Now that I'm working full time in the U.S., it's hard for me to go and spend really long periods of time, but I adapt those methods. So I'll go and spend 2 weeks, a month with people, ideally in their, you know, in their within their communities. And as I'm doing that, I'm also, if I have political particular projects I'm working on, I'll go to the kinds of events that are relevant for my project. I'll talk to people about the research questions that I'm interested in. And then I will do some more directed interviews and more focused research as things move on. But a really, really big part of ethnographic research methods is relationships. So in some research strategies, like people might be know about people who do more straight up interviews or surveys, you're really going and just trying to get information from people and then you leave. Whereas with ethnographic research, you developing real relationships. So those relationships often extend far beyond the research moment. So you benefit from developing friends and extended family members, as well as whatever, you know, the data is that you're collecting for your project.
Do you then stay in, after you move on to another project, do you stay in touch with the previous folks?
I do. I mean, it's kind of the ideal that you do forever, but as with any social relationships, there's some people that I end up having a closer relationship with and others that I eventually fall out of touch with. But I started doing research in Malawi when I was a graduate student in 1996, I think. So I have some friends that are very close friends that live in Malawi that I've known since that time. But of course, many others I've lost touch mm-hmm. with.
So give me a range. Where all of you done research?
So most of my research up until recently has been in Malawi. I've done several projects in Malawi, which is, for those who don't know, a small country in southern Africa. I've also done research in the United States. And then more recently, starting in 2021, it was supposed to be earlier, but that pesky COVID hit, I started doing a multi-site global project. I should explain that part of ethnographic research methods is you're supposed to like learn the language and learn the culture, and you know, in order to really immerse yourself in a place, it requires a lot of time. So it's, again, that's part of the process is you get to know one place, and it could be within your own culture or outside. You get to know it really well because you have to know it well to do the research. The project I'm doing now is a little different because I don't have the same kind of long-term knowledge about the places, but I was really interested in understanding more about displaced people and refugees and thinking about it globally. So my current project is in multiple locations. So it's in Malawi, and there I'm focusing on the refugee camp where Divine lived and her family still lives. And then also with in France, I'm doing research with Uyghurs. For those who don't know, Uyghurs are an ethnic minority in China, though they think of themselves as a colonized people. And then in Turkey, I'm doing research with Syrians who fled the civil war that started in 2011. And then in the United States, I'm doing research with some students at my university who came to the United States as refugee and are in the arts MFA program.
Yeah. Is there a through line, arts? Is that a kind of a
through line? Yeah, the through line is arts. So my project is doing a couple of things, but a big part of it, well, it's kind of three big prongs. One is that when we talk about refugees, most people know very little about refugees. And when I say most people, I mean even some refugees don't know very much about other refugees, but also policymakers, government officials who are making decisions, but also citizens of countries where there are a lot of refugees, and that's almost every country in the world. There's often a lot of kind of misconceptions and ideas that flow around about these people that has very little to do with who they are as you know, like what they, who they are as just humans, but also why they left their homes, why they can't go back, what they're doing in the location, where their futures might lie, whether they have a future, you know, whether they feel like they have a future. So there's just a lot of misconceptions and misinformation. And I was really interested in trying to find ways of myself learning about it, but also communicating and educating people to dispel some of the negative misconceptions that I think also lead to a lot of policies and a lot of just cultural aspects that make it very, very difficult for refugees to exist in the spaces that they're in. So I was interested in this idea of a refugee crisis. You hear about that all over the world, both that we have a global refugee crisis and we have a refugee crisis in lots of different countries, but in reality, it's not one crisis. And really, the crisis is that so many people aren't safe at home and have to leave, rather than the crisis being the people that are, you know, desperately seeking a place to be. So I was thinking about, well, how do you tell these stories? And I thought, well, let's, you know, what would be a way to really find out about and share positive stories that would help to humanize people. So they would both show the diversity of who refugees are, try to educate people about kind of the range of different kinds of experiences, but also, you know, once you start getting to know real human beings, it often can really change how you feel about a larger category of people. And the arts were a really interesting way to focus it because one is arts are often about expression, about identity, about community, about joy, about entertainment. And these are things that often aren't part of the rhetoric about refugees. So there's a lot of really positive things. The other thing is art is really important when you're traumatized or when you're removed from your culture environment or when your identity is completely shaken up and you're not quite sure who you are, where you are, how you belong. Art can be a really important way for people to anchor themselves, to express themselves, to connect with other people, both people who are like themselves, but also people who are very different. I've been throughout my research, people, you know, will say like you can listen to anybody's music and enjoy it and feel the emotional response and you know, want to jump up and dance or want to cry or whatever. You don't have to know very much about that music, right? Art can be a connector. At the same time, as if you're with other people who come from your own cultural background, if you're participating in musical practices together that are from your home country, that can be a really profound way of still being part of your own culture together, but in a very far removed place. So the arts and the humanizing and providing counter narratives to the negative, that a lot of the negativities are kind of three of the main goals. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'll come back, have some follow-ups there, but I want to turn back to Divan Irokoze. Mm-hmm. So you were pretty young when your family ended up in the refugee camp, right?
I was actually born in a refugee
camp. Oh, you were born there, so very, very young. Yes, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's, until recently, that's what you knew.
Yeah. So my parents moved from Burundi. So they're originally from Burundi, and that's in... It's also a small country in East Africa. So they moved in 1994 during the Civil War, and they moved to Tanzania. And they stayed there for a few years, and that's where I was born. And in 2004, they moved to Malawi, and they moved in the refugee camp in Malawi. And since then, that's where we have been till like... I think about 2 years ago when I moved to the States mm-hmm. for school. But yeah, all my life, everything that I have known was just around the refugee camp.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell me, what was your life like in the refugee camp?
It was, I don't know, it was a little bit of both. I don't know, because there's a lot of challenges for sure. Lack of opportunities. You just see some things you don't even know they exist, or the opportunities. You just have to learn to accept who you are or what you have or the opportunities that are there. So it was hard getting a chance to go to school. Like, I think growing up when I was young, we only had like one or two blocks for the childhood education, early childhood education, I would say. So I can tell you not every child got a chance to get into a school. And some of them, since they're young and growing up in that kind of hard environment, when they are reaching the age of, let me say, maybe 5 or 8, they're being now trained to start helping parents in, like, helping them find things to do or to, like, earn a living or stuff like that. So they're trained to start earning a living at that early age simply because they're not even getting an opportunity to go to school. So if you get a chance to get that education, that's good for you. And then the other time you can get lucky to get that education, but the moment you're done, you won't have anything to use that education for. So I would give example in Malawi, they have some strict policies for refugees, which one of them, they do not have a work permit for refugees. So it doesn't matter how educated or smart you are. Once you're done, because the government hasn't granted work permit for refugees, so you get to stuck in that refugee camp again. So you just like live in there, your dreams, your passions or your career goals and everything. You don't even have time to think about that. The only thing you'll be thinking about will be like, how am I going to survive the next day? What kind of food am I eating the next day? And just to like around there. And so it's really as hard as and crazy as it sounds.
Yeah, that must be hard. So you essentially can't leave the camp.
No, you can't.
Right.
But it's a little more complicated than that. So just to because I think a lot of people in the U.S. have a very particular idea of what an African refugee camp might look like. It's, as Divine started off, she said both. Like, on the one hand, it's you can go in and out. There's no wall around it. You don't have to check in with anybody when you go in. And it's, if you don't know it's a refugee camp, it looks like it's just a thriving small city. So there's like 52,000 people living there. And Divine's family, they live in a house with how many bedrooms? There's a lot of bedrooms.
Yeah.
Every time I go, I discover a new bedroom. Five or six bedrooms. There's a sitting room. They have a kitchen area. They have a wall around their house. There's no running water at any houses in the camp, but there's electricity. And there's roads. They're dirt roads, but people, there's cars, there's motorcycles, there's bikes, there's restaurants, there's clinics, there's photography studios, there's tailors, there's hair places. So it's a thriving city, and all the businesses are residents of the camp, so people who are asylum seekers or refugees. And you can go in and out of the camp, you can go into the city and back. So in on the one hand, if you know, like when I'm there, I'm like, oh, this is a great place. It's actually kind of fun. It's really, there's a lot of energy, there's a lot going on. But then if you just peel back one layer, then you find out that, yeah, people can have their own businesses, but only within the camp. And if you're there for 5 months, that's okay. But if you're there for 30 years, that's a little bit limited. They can, like Divine's brother was one of the few people who was able to go to university and get his degree, but he can't. He has a college degree, which is a very tiny population percentage in Malawi of people get access to college, to college education. But now that he has his degree, he's not allowed to work. So there's like, it's kind of an interesting thing where people can live, but there's, because they can't work, they're not supposed to leave the camp for more than 24 hours. There's an enormous amount of xenophobia and anti-refugee sentiment. And they, you know, don't have a, because they can't work, they can have businesses, but their salaries are really capped, so they don't have access to money to do a lot of things. Their lives are really restricted, and a lot of them are just, you know, they just need, they want desperately to just live somewhere where they can live freely and pursue opportunities. So it's not as desperate as you might imagine in terms of, on one level, though of course there's incredible amounts of poverty, as you can imagine, and a lot of people who are coming more recently are fleeing conflict right now. So the other thing is that, like, Divine's family from Burundi and most of the families from Rwanda left during the genocides in those countries in the early 1990s. They can't go back because it's not safe. You also have a huge number of people coming in daily from right now from the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there's conflict going on right now. So you also have, everybody has histories of trauma, but they go back different, kind of different amount of times. Is that, Divine, I don't mean to, I just wanted to add a little more explanation about the camp.
Yeah, I guess that was the misperception you were talking about.
Yeah.
Elisa. So there, you know, there's some positive aspects, but the, I guess the lack of opportunities to explore, to progress is a limiting factor.
Yes, yeah. It is. And I would say it does mostly affect like young generation, because some of the kids that grew up there, they really moved in when they're like really young. Like I moved there when I was 3 or 4 years. And then so everything that I knew was just within that refugee camp. So if I get to grow up and I'm like not being able to like have access to opportunities and like being able to explore, that can be a little bit hard. And also trying to like finding a way of surviving with that within that same environment. And that comes into like maybe seeing if there's any kind of business that I have to come up with, business ideas, or if I have any talent that I could use, which mostly is also not being exposed as much. And some of these kids were even born there. I have kids that are like, I have friends that are even older than me, but they were born in Malawi in that refugee camp. But then due to all these like limited opportunities that are there, then can be a little bit hard. And that would be like really mostly on the big negative side of it. But the positive side is just like having to accept who they are and trying to thrive and coming up with those ideas and like small businesses, like small skills and stuff like that.
Well, let's take a break. We're overdue for a break here. We'll have much more to talk about. We are talking with George Mason University folklorist and ethnographer Lisa Gilman, and with BYU Idaho student and refugee advocate Divine Irokoze. They're going to give this year's Five Folklore Honor Lecture together at Utah State University. That is today, 1:30 this afternoon, in Merrill Kazir Library Room 101. You're welcome to attend Merrill Kazir Library Room 101. And that is presented by the USU College of Humanities and Social Sciences, Harawi Peace Institute, Folklore Program, University Libraries and Special Collections and Archives. The title of that talk is Refugees, Arts, and Advocacy. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I'm talking right now with the presenters of the Fife Folklore Honor Lecture. It happens every year at Utah State University. That'll be happening 1:30 this afternoon. You're welcome to attend Merrill Kazir Library Room 101. The presenters are with me, George Mason University folklorist and ethnographer Lisa Gilman, and refugee advocate and now BYU Idaho student Divine Irokoze. To begin this segment, Divine Irokoze, now that you can dream a bit, what are your dreams right now? What are you working toward?
So I'm currently doing, like I said earlier, I'm doing international studies, and I'm just looking into going to the humanitarian works and pretty much advocate for fellow refugees as well, because the older I get, the more I realize and learn about how refugees are being represented and are being treated and, you know, all those things. And I just want to be in a place whereby I will be able to, like, voice out for them, like, voice out for fellow refugees that are not able to, like, speak out for themselves, and also bring out, like, what we don't talk about much is how the resilience and strength and, you know, talent and passion for refugees. And we have heard so many stories about who refugees are and all those struggles. We can't run away from those facts, you know, but they're also a very bigger picture to what, like, we don't see, like how really amazing they are, what kind of contribution they're bringing in the development of the countries where they're being hosted in, and how smart and talented and all those things. So my career goals is to really be in that place whereby I have to like speak out for fellow refugees and bring the light or the brighter side of them that has not been really exposed or shared before.
Yeah, yeah, great goal. Lisa Gilman, I want to get into how you guys met, but before we do that, I want to take this to a larger view, right? There'd be, you said, about 50,000 people in this refugee camp, which is really a city, you know, but with some limitations. I don't know what the number is, hundreds of thousands of people.
Worldwide?
In worldwide,
no,
yeah.
Millions and millions.
Millions.
And millions. I wish I had the number with me. It's like 128 million people right now. Divine's looking it up.
Yeah.
It's an astronomical amount, and it's growing now at a faster rate than it ever has before. And this includes, you know, when we talk about displaced people, a lot of people are fleeing conflict and persecution. There's a lot of people fleeing climate crisis where their homes are no longer safe places to live. There's also a lot of internal displacement, like in Sudan. There's like huge, it's like a million, some very large number of people that are, you know, fleeing one part of their country and have to go to another part where it's not their home and there's no resources for them. The Syrians alone, just in Turkey, got up to about 4 million, just to give you a sense. And now the Assad regime fell, so some are going back. What's the number?
The number is, it says as of April 2024, there were more than 120 million.
So yeah. I think the last number I saw was 128 million. So that would make sense.
Yeah,
it's a year later.
The number keeps increasing every month.
And you know, there are probably other, you know, probably many other folks more educated than I am, but others who would be in you know, have my perception that badly underestimating this and not recognizing that how many people are in this situation.
Yeah, I think that there's some. And it's not your fault, right? It's really Divine brought up the word representation before. It's like we hear it in the news, but we don't get a sense of the overall picture. And also when you say 128 million, like when I see that number, I'm just like, you know, it just, I don't know, it's too big and too abstract for me even to understand what that is. But when you start like looking in different places, I mean, just, you know, you'll go to one country alone, or I was supposed to go last summer to refugee camps in Bangladesh, where Rohingya people who are being basically killed off by the government in Myanmar. You know, there's millions of people just there. And so, I mean, just when you start talking about millions of people, that's just like a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And the other interesting thing is that, you know, the United States really talks a lot about the problem of all the people coming here. But if you look globally, we're only hosting a very tiny percentage of the overall numbers. A huge percentage of refugees are actually in kind of very low-resourced countries that don't have, where there's a lot of poverty and where there's not a lot of resources for the existing population. So also, like, as we're talking about the positive things, I think sometimes, you know, people push back a little bit when I present and they'll say, well, what about, you know, the problems are real. Like when you have millions of people coming into a country or thousands of people, they do need resources. And that is very true. Like that, you know, if there's a limited resources and you have a lot of people that come in that need to eat and they need to drink water and they need to access medical care and education, of course, that puts a strain on the local country. But I think the problem is that we kind of we position it that the people who have to flee are the problem rather than, I mean, the real problem is that all across the world, I mean, literally all across the world, you have people who are so unsafe that they have to leave their homes. Like they don't want to. I mean, one of the themes in my research is, you know, people are so frustrated that they're not being considered to be kind of human beings. And they were like, you know, we're human, we're just people. You know, if you'd asked me 10 years ago and told me I was going to be here, I would be like, there's absolutely no way. Look at me living my nice life in my country. Like, there's no way I'm going to be leaving. You know, like these things just happen very suddenly. And then people are just fleeing for their lives or, you know, I mean, people leave in a lot of different kinds of circumstances. But the, you know, the problem again is that so many people are having to leave. You know, I wish that more of our focus in the world was how do we create more security and safety and places so people can thrive, and whether that's economically or politically or socially or so yeah, it's huge. I mean, the more I do this research, the more it's very hard, you know, because you just start seeing, you know, just kind of recognizing how many people are living in really, really precarious positions. And when in my doing my research, I get to know people, right? So it's like when I get to see, when I met Divine, she's the same age as my daughter, you know? And I was like, well, wait a minute, you know, why doesn't she get to do the things that my daughter gets to do, you know, just because of where she was born? And so it's pretty intense.
Well, let's have you tell the story. How did you guys meet?
We met in November 2021. So I think Lisa had traveled to Malawi for the festival. We do have like a festival that usually happens once a year. And it was actually founded by a former refugee. I don't know if he's still a refugee, but yeah. And what's his name? Menes
La Plume.
Yeah.
Or Tresor.
Yeah. So he also actually, I think, if I'm right, if I can remember, the inspiration behind him starting the festival was the idea to like bring together the refugees' talent and being able to like expose the refugee art and talent, and also having people worldwide come to attend the festival and get to learn more about what refugees are doing and all this talent, and like also help them to like a little bit have fun and forget the stress and the struggles and stuff like that. So Lisa had traveled. She probably have learned more about this festival than I did, because that's how I take the research. So she can talk more, a little bit more about it. But yeah, she had traveled for that festival in Malawi. And this festival, what they do, they also have what they call homestay program. So they do have, when people travel, they get, because the festival is happening within the refugee camp.
There's
so
no hotels in there.
Yeah, there are no hotels. And they help to get families that can host the guests or the people that have traveled for the festival. And so Lisa, I got lucky to have Lisa with us. And that's how we met, and she stayed with my family, and we connected like that. And yeah, and here we are today.
Yeah.
The rest is history.
The rest is history. Yeah. What would you say about it?
Yeah, so this festival is the inspiration for my global project called My Culture, My Survival Art Initiatives by Refugees for Refugees. I had heard about this festival. I read about it in a newspaper article. And I was like, wow, like I've heard that there's a refugee camp in Malawi, but I've never been there. It never occurred to me to go there. But there's an arts festival happening and it's getting all this coverage. You know, I think I want to meet, I want to go and go to the festival. And so I'd had this plan to go to the festival, but then COVID hit. And then finally in October 2021, I was like, wait, we're using Zoom to teach and to do all this stuff. So I bet I could like talk to the guy, even though I can't travel. So I contacted Tresor, the founder of the festival, and I said, hey, you know, can I interview you about the festival? I'm really interested in it. And he was like, you know, I'm happy to talk to you, but if you want to really understand the festival, you should come. And it was October, and my university was like, no travel because of COVID, but it was just opening up. So I just sent an email and I was like, could I travel? And they said, yes, if you sign 20,000 documents saying that you're not going to sue anybody. And so, like within a month, I was at the festival, and the festival is really radical. I mean, it's hard to explain, but it's a 3-day festival that goes from noon until like 3 a.m. And it's just, there's multiple stages throughout the camp that have music and dance, both traditional dance and popular dance. And the music is like, popular Congolese music, popular Malawian music, rock, gospel, rap, I mean, everything. There's a poetry pavilion. There's a theater pavilion.
Yeah.
There's a visual arts. There's like just arts everywhere. And as Vine was saying, what's really radical about it, and Tresor is an incredibly brilliant man. And
it's actually one of the biggest festivals that happens in Malawi. So
So now in Malawi, it is completely free. So in Malawi, it's like you can go to the Lake of Stars Festival. You can go to, I forget what the other ones are. And Tumaini is one of the big festivals in the country. Mm-hmm. This isn't a country of people who really don't want that refugee camp and typically say very bad things about refugees or don't know very much about them. Mm-hmm. But now if you want to go see like Chisora is incredible because he has friends with all the artists in Malawi. So he gets the most famous musicians to perform in the camp for free. So Malawians flood to this festival because it's a way to see the arts. And then the radical thing is that once you're in the camp, you have no choice but to interact with other refugees as fellow with refugees as human beings. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you're walking from one stage to the next, you see their housing, you see how they live. When you want to buy a soda, you're buying it from a refugee business, so you're supporting them. Mm-hmm. And then the homestay program is also very radical because and it's very strategic. He's incredibly smart, but his idea is that, you know, if you get to know another person as a human being, it's you're going to think about them as another human being, and that's the premise of bringing people into the camp. So the homestay program, the idea is people who come for the festival, they have nowhere to stay, so they put them up with families. And once you're staying with somebody and eating breakfast with them and showering in the same shower, you know it's hard not to just see them as people, and you have to interact with them and get to know them. And you pay a little bit of money, so it also has an economic benefit to the families. So when I was going, Tresor was like, you have to do the homestay. And it was all so last minute. So I think Divine's family has hosted a lot of people. So I think there's kind of like, okay, will you take another person? And they're like, yeah, sure, whatever. We'll take another person. Anyway, so I showed up at Divine's home. And I think because I have some language, like I speak French and I speak some Chichewa, and I'm around the same age as her parents.
She speaks good Chichewa. She's being
She does. Okay.
Tease me. Divine teases me. Well, actually, the truth is that Divine's mother and I both speak really bad Chichewa.
Yeah.
But we both are people who really love to talk and communicate, and we will do whatever we need to communicate. And so I think the kids always think it's hilarious listening to us talk. But I think Divine's mother and I very quickly bonded because they've had a lot of people stay there, but I think I was the only one that she could communicate with other than smiling and feeding really, really well. They're a really, really beautiful dynamic family. And so it was really, I think we connected, but for me it was a really profound experience. And then I got to know Divine was my host. She was the person in charge of me, but she was so busy because she was volunteering at the festival. And so she would kind of look in on me every once in a while.
You got a chance to interact with my mom, though.
I got to interact with your mom and get to know Deborah. No, and I met so many people, and I had an amazing time. And it was at the festival, through interacting, I met so many young people and so many artists. And it was at that festival that inspired. I was writing a book already about the, you know, refugees all over the world, or that was the plan. And then it was meeting, just being at the festival, that inspired this project that Divine and I ended up working on.
Well, let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment with George Mason University folklorist and ethnographer Lisa Gilman and refugee advocate and BYU-Idaho student Divine Iturkoze. As you heard there, they met at the Malawian refugee camp where Divine grew up, lived until recently, and they're working on a joint project, and they're giving the Fife Folklore Honor Lecture jointly, and the title of that is Refugees, Arts, and Advocacy. That's happening at 1:30 today, Merrill Kazir Library, Room 101, Merrill Kazir Library, Room 101, and you're invited to attend that, free and open to the public. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access UTime. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with George Mason University folklorist and ethnographer Lisa Gilman and with refugee advocate and BYU-Idaho student Divine Iturkoze. They're jointly giving this year's Fife Folklore Honor Lecture titled Refugees, Arts, and Advocacy. And so that's happening at 1:30 this afternoon on the USU campus, Merrill Kazir Library, Room 101, and everyone is invited. So, Lisa Gilman, tell me a little bit more about I guess I'll have you both. I'll direct this to you first. The role, you're going to be talking this presentation about the place, the important place that arts and culture play in the lives of displaced peoples.
Yeah, so I can talk about that generally, but I think I'll anchor it in the camp because it's so it makes it a little easier to talk about. But maybe I'll do it more generally. But the arts and culture are, first of all, they're just widespread. When it doesn't matter whether people are in the midst of fleeing or they're somewhere temporarily or they're going long term, they've been somewhere long term, but you always see a lot. People are just expressing themselves artistically and culturally. I mean, it's really striking. Like, we've seen images of Palestinians painting on debris after bombings. We see people singing to their children to soothe them, while they're in transit. And, it's like really kind of at every step. So I think in the camp, you have it's a very vibrant art scene. And this festival has done a lot to motivate other people to develop as artistically and to develop initiatives. And so you have, there's like a lot of different nonprofits, official and not, that there's a lot of teaching youth art, which is a way to occupy youth who don't have a lot, going on. It's a lot for people themselves who are feeling really hopeless if they'll do arts, but also by teaching art to other people or finding ways to help other people make money through the arts, it helps give meaning to their lives and they start to have some, rather than thinking about their hopeless, feeling that their future is hopeless, realizing that they're doing something important now. You have a lot of arts used in different kind of faith-based activities. A lot of worship has music and dance as a really big part of it. People expressing themselves for trauma, like if people that are able to paint or depict images that are related to grief or loss or traumatic events can be really good on a mental health level. It builds community. It builds connection. As we were just saying with the festival, Malawians coming and enjoying or even performing together with residents of the camp helps to bring kind of commonality and a shared aesthetics and shared just having fun together. If you're just standing together dancing with other people, you feel like you're there's a connection that happens on a kind of embodied way. So it has a lot. That's kind of just the tip of the iceberg. So I wanted to briefly just talk about the project that Divine and I ended up have been collaborating on, which is called the Zalika Art Project. So Zalika is the name of the camp. And the idea came, it was very impulsive on my part, but when I was in the camp, I just kept meeting these young artists who were like, hey, there's so much talent. We have so much skill in the camp, but we're having trouble getting audiences. We can't sell our work. People don't know we're here. People just kind of think of us as refugees. They don't think of us as the talented people we are. And so I came up with an idea that grows out of a public folklore, comes out of an ideal way of doing work in our field, which is to create a collaborative project where young people in the camp who are already leaders and are already involved with arts initiatives would document arts in the camp. And then I went back to my university at Mason and I was able to identify some undergraduate students to work on the project with the idea that youth working with youth across the world would build advocacy and knowledge and understanding in the way that the festival is supposed to, like kind of when you come together with other people. As humans, you respect each other. So I had I worked with three undergraduates and eventually a couple graduate students at Mason. And the way the project worked is that there were six team leaders in the camp. One was in charge of photography, one visual arts, poetry, music, dance, and then Divine was in charge of inspirational stories. And the idea was that they were the leaders, that they documented the arts and the people that they knew about. So it's not me deciding who's important or what I know, but it's really their project, their documentation project, but we're making it happen because we have the resources to kind of produce a website and a book and whatnot. And so each of the team leaders ended up, we have about 100 artists documented in all. And for each one, there's a photograph of the person, a brief biography that was collected by mostly by the team members, and then an example of the art. So if it was a poetry, it'd be a poem. If it was a painting, it'd be a photograph of the painting. And so we have, it was supposed to be a book. This is kind of a cool story. It was supposed to be a book, and I'm working to get a publisher on that now. And then one of the undergraduate students that was working with me, Solomon, he came to the U.S. as a refugee from Sierra Leone. And so it was really cool for him because he had never been back to Africa. So for him, communicating with these young people who were refugees in a camp was really interesting. And he was getting his degree in web development. So he was like, hey, we should make a website. And I was like, no, we don't have the resources. And he was like, no, we should really make a website. I want to make it. So I was like, well, I'm not going to say no to Solomon. So then Solomon ended up building a website. And so the website is also like a product of youth and youth working together and vision and leadership. So that was really cool. So I'm going to hand it over to Divine. I know I just talked a lot, but to talk a little bit about you could talk about your experience working on the project and the value that you see in it.
It was such a very fun and knowledgeable, I would say, experience. For me, it was also more of like an eye-opening, I don't know if I call it like that, because I have been in that refugee camp for more than 10 years. And I didn't realize how much of talented young people and talent and skills and smart young people we really had in the community until Lisa just showed up and she's like, hey, we've got a project to work on. And then I get an opportunity to work on it, and I'm realizing how much of all these amazing talents that we have in the refugee camp, but that never got an opportunity to, like, be exposed and be shared out there. So it was such a very, very amazing experience, I would say, because it gave me an opportunity to, like, interact with other young people and get to learn more of them, and also get to learn how best we can be able to share ourselves there, share all these amazing stories that I was talking about refugees. Because right now, I can challenge you that if you get on Google and type who's a refugee, they will tell you. Of course, that's the definition of a refugee. Like, they will show you pictures of refugees carrying heavy bags or moving from one place to another and tell you how maybe stressed or miserable, how much of problems they have, but they won't show you another positive side of the who a refugee is, you know, because now that's when comes in this talent that we're talking about. Like, that Google or like maybe whoever works on those websites, they won't tell you, like, however, apart from refugees being all these, this is also their resilience and strength and talent and, you know, some of the good things that we can learn about them. So this project really helped me and also added something to, like, was also like another inspiring thing to learn from with what I want to do in the future. I was like, oh, actually, we do have all these things, but the world really has a very different definition of who we are and what we can do as refugees. Another funny story, actually, when I got here, the first time I got at school, I met my roommates, and all of them are just like, you know, they were, I think we're all freshmen in the apartment if we didn't have another one who's been there for longer. But obviously, we're going to stay together. We're doing introductions as roommates, and everyone is just telling the fun story. Hey, this is me. I'm from this place, blah, blah, blah. Everyone has everything to say about where they are from. But then for me, that has also been one of the things that I really struggled with through over time, and mostly also being here, BYUI has really been a challenge, because if you meet someone, they'll be like, hey, what's your name and where are you from? Mm-hmm. So for me, it's always like I have to find really, how do I make sense of all this movement I've made? Oh, my parents are from here, but I was born here and now I was raised here and now I'm here. You know, I just don't have one word that would define me. But I think, I guess I do have one word that would define me as a refugee. So I'm telling my roommate that, oh, hey, guys, I have a different story. I was born in a refugee camp and I just came from a refugee camp. And they're like, how do you speak English? A refugee who speaks English? I was like, yeah, I can speak English because I went to school, despite that I'm a refugee. And they were like, don't you guys live in tent? How can you go to school? Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't blame them because that's what they know. You know, that's what the world has also let most people know not everyone really understands what refugee is and what they can do. So, like, having these kind of projects that it's bringing out, like, another different side or positive stories about refugees, I feel like it was really such a brilliant idea and very helpful.
Well, we're out of time. Well, much more we could say. Yes.
Can we just give the address for the...
Yes. Okay. Yes, definitely.
So Zalika is spelled D-Z-A-L-E-K-I. D-Z-E. Wait. D-Z-A-L-E-K-I. Okay.
I'll
scratch
help
that. Zalika.
I'll help you. It's D-Z-A-L-E-K-A.
Yes. And the website is zalikaartproject.com.
Okay, ZalikaArtProject.com. Wonderful. Wonderful. So go and check that out, and hopefully a book will be forthcoming as well on that. The talk to be given by Lisa Gilman and Divine Irokoze is called Refugees, Arts, and Advocacy. That's the Fife Folklore Honor Lecture, and it's today at 1:30, Merrill Kazir Library 101. Everyone is welcome. Thanks to you both for coming in. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You. Thank you
thank
for
you.
Having us.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.